Именно граждане определили итоги избирательной кампании.
Ведь настоящих выборов в России не было с 96 года.
Выбрали путь созидательного развития.
К сожалению, мы уже привыкли к тому, что голосование ничего не решает.
Доказали, что мы живем в здоровом,
уверенном. Смогу ли я и те, кто поддержит меня, сделать Россию лучше?
Иммунитет к популизму и демагогии.
Я иду на выборы, и я буду бороться за победу.
Vladimir Putin boasted in his State of the Nation speech that Russia is immune to the anti-establishment fever sweeping the West. Alexei Navalny is betting that he's wrong. When he announced that he intends to run for president in 2018, the anti-corruption blogger and opposition figure pledged to make Russia, quote, rich, free, strong, and modern. Sound familiar? Navalny's clearly learned something from the populist wave that led to the Brexit vote in the United Kingdom, the election of Donald Trump in the United States, and the rise of Marine Le Pen in France. Can the populist anti-establishment tsunami that's engulfed the West also strike Russia? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And joining us via Skype from Moscow is journalist Anna Arutunyan, author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. Welcome back, Anna.
Great to be here again.
Great to have you. As I argued in the blog this week, like his Western counterparts, Navalny also taps into a populist cocktail that includes ethnic nationalism, anger about corruption, and fatigue about an entrenched elite. In the West, this has been a potent political force, largely due to an industrial working class that feels it's been left behind by globalization. Mark, do you see, leaving aside the question of Navalny for the moment, do you see a similar reservoir of discontent in Russia?
Yes, I think it's a different reservoir. I mean, there's a danger of assuming that just because, as it were, there is the potential for populism in Russia, and we've already seen it happen in the West, it's the same populism, which I don't believe it is. But I absolutely think that what we are seeing at the moment in Russia is a sense of a dream unfulfilled. That, in fact, the kind of Russia that Putin promised, and in fairness, did win him previous elections, mm-hmm. even if they were also then sort of massaged up to provide the proper legitimating levels. But nonetheless, I think there's no doubt that actually that, you know, there is this substantial support for Putin. But I think what we've seen is precisely that the substantial support for Putin, the man, has maintained. But I think that we see that support for Putin, shall we say, the vision, the program, the structure, that is definitely on the wane. And this is where Navalny could come in.
Mm-hmm. And you think a potential reservoir that is from nationalists, yeah?
I think that's part of it. And again, I think, always a terrible cliche about perfect storms. But nonetheless, I mean, I think we see at the moment clearly growing pressure on the working class.
Mm-hmm.
And that's already visible in labour unrest, however fragmentary and so forth it is. And in some ways, the very fact that it's fragmentary and not organised by trade union structures says something about precisely the degree of anger mm-hmm. that is behind it. People are willing to do this themselves.
Without being told to.
Exactly, mm-hmm. and without the protection of a structure to look after them. So we have labour unrest, we have a middle class which is sort of shrinking dramatically and unhappy, and again, these are the people very much whom Navalny first called on. And although numerically they're not great, they're still focused in Moscow, which is basically what matters, and they have certain characteristics, in particular their capacity to communicate and so forth, which could be useful. I think there's the risk of, obviously, concerns within the elite if they feel that, in fact, the direction that Putin is taking them is a road to a cliff rather than anywhere else. And finally, we also have exactly the nationalism card. And the thing about nationalism is precisely it has the potential to cut across regional and class divides.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you know, it can be a powerful cohering factor.
Mm-hmm. Now, Anna, you spent a lot of time talking to Russian nationalists, and as a matter of fact, together with Mark, you published a recent article in which you argued that they are in the process of revolting against the Kremlin. What do you see in terms of the potential for a populist revolt in Russia?
Before before we get into the nationalists, I wanted to address populism and anti-establishment sentiment in the Russian context, because I feel that that's where it gets really, really different. I'd say we're really talking almost the direct reversal of the trends we're seeing in the West. And as such, I'd place Navalny, as a matter of fact, as an establishment phenomenon rather than an anti-establishment phenomenon. And there's two reasons for that. One is that Russia's Supreme Court overturned his verdict in the Kirov-Lesk case just recently, thus lifting the ban on him running for office. And this is, of course, in the Russian context, a political decision that can itself be overturned at the Kremlin's will. But what it indicates is that the Kremlin might actually be eager to have Putin beat Navalny in the elections, because the real question isn't for Putin who's going to win, it's who is Putin going to beat. And at this point, it might as well be Navalny. And secondly, what is anti-establishment sentiment in Russia? And realistically, Russians have been, I'd say, anti-establishment all along, maybe even before it was cool. Take trust polls, and you'll see the president has the highest trust ratings. This is indicative of personalized rule, placing belief in the person rather than the institution. And another funny thing I noticed just going through the polls, approval of the State Duma right now is pretty low, but it's actually grown over the years, according to Levada, 18% in 2000, 44% last month. And I'm talking about approval, not trust. That's a different indicator. If we take Gallup, for instance, for U.S. Congress, it's gone down from 19% to 9% between 2006 and now. And we've seen other polls in the United States showing a marked decline of support in, for the political system between 2006-2014, especially among young people. Whereas in Russia, what we're really seeing is a steadily low support of the political system, maybe fluctuating, and high support of the person in power, which is really all that matters. So in that context, if we look at any sort of protest, and the Bolotnaya protest in particular in 2012, this was more about a drive towards institutional legitimacy. In other words, creating a political establishment rather than personalized rule. This is what the protesters were really after. And the funny thing that came out of the article that Mark and I did about the nationalists when we were talking to them is that they had actually, aside from the clearly populist rhetoric, they'd also absorbed a lot of these traditionally liberal positions. They started talking about rule of law, strong courts, strong parliament. This wasn't so much about military rule, it really was about democracy. So, I mean, in the sense that Russian establishment is personalized rule, yes, anti-establishment sentiment is growing. But in a way, that's because Russians haven't, they haven't had democracy. They've had personalized populism for so long. Now they're revolting against that.
So anti-establishmentism in Russia is, in the Russian context, is a pro-democratic phenomenon? Is that where we're going here?
Okay, I mean, yeah, it's a little bit like the kids of hippies deciding to become accountants as their act of rebellion. But at the same time, we've got to think about what is it that actually motivates people? I mean, it's not so much abstract concepts as qualities of life, aspects of their life. And if you look at what Russians at the moment are complaining about, yeah, of course, it's about certain nuts and bolts in terms of payments being made, not made on time, and pensions declining in their absolute value. But in general terms, it's about predictability of life. It's about a sense of unfairness, about a sense that they are at the mercy of predatory officials, about the lack of any kind of real recourse. And the point is that in some ways, the whole kind of patrimonial regime, the Tsar will look after you, is clearly at the moment not doing that. They're clearly not benefiting from it. So this is why almost as a sort of default, people are going back to a notion which was, after all, thoroughly discredited in the 1990s, the idea of democracy. And this is a fascinating thing, that this is why, you know, the nationalists themselves, in some ways they've worked their way through different iterations. They have thought that maybe the answer is just simply a different, better Vojd, or whatever. And now they too are coming to this notion that actually democracy, with all its checks and balances and so forth, gets them what they think they want.
I'm a little bit skeptical of this, to be honest. I mean, I read your piece that you and Anna wrote together. I thought it was an excellent piece, but it strikes me that a couple of things. this is one strain of the nationalists. It's not. Sure. I don't think this is a widespread sentiment among Russian nationalists, is that we want democracy. But also, I'm a little bit skeptical of it in that it reeks of opportunism. When you're on the outs, you want democracy. When you're in, you don't, so to speak.
Except
so isn't
the
there a bit
thing
of
is that?
That?
But the point is, they're not just simply saying democracy. It's actually that, and you're absolutely right, this is just a particular strand. And the trouble is, nationalist embraces everything from the swastika thug who actually just simply believes it means putting the boot into some Azeri market traders, all the way through to these more intellectual sort of thinker types. But we've assumed that basically these are the kind of people who construct the structures and the narratives through which politics is organized. And yeah, I mean, there is an element to which one might think, oh, well, it's just opportunism. But the interesting thing is that they actually are talking about the nuts and bolts, or to put it another way, the building blocks of democracy. Things like rule of law, things like not just, oh, we're against corruption, which in the past meant we'll drag people out of their dachas and shoot them against a wall. But now is actually, and therefore there need to be courts that are truly independent, enshrined within the constitution, etc. All these kind of elements. Sure, this is not necessarily something that instantly appeals to the tattooed thug, because there is no such thing as a single nationalist movement.
Right.
And what that just as easily embraces followers of Putin and followers of the Communist Party. But on the other hand, it does suggest that there is actually an interesting convergence of different forces.
Yeah. Now, what you're speaking about is mostly the Sputnik and Pogrom crowd, the people that write and read that website is my understanding. And that is one of the more influential voices in the nationalist constellation. Anna, I'd like to actually get you to jump in because this is kind of your hobby horse.
I was going to jump in myself on Sputnik and Pogrom. Yes, this is a strand of nationalism, but what's interesting is that this strand exists, and it's a pretty strong strand. And I just noticed an article on about a month ago on Sputnik and Pogrom that was actually arguing for sexual education, against slut shaming, for more acceptance of sex as a phenomenon. And I was just really surprised to see this on Sputnik and Pogrom of all places. And this was kind of going against the Kremlin's return to traditional values and saying, look, we need to live in the real world. And this really struck me as, yes, they're talking about democracy to embrace, whatever to get into power. But this was actually voicing a certain genuine sentiment that kind of ran against the whole patrimonialism trend we've been seeing from the top for many years. And I think that's important.
It's interesting. I mean, we see three strains here, basically, that are feeding into this phenomenon. On one is these, I guess you call the Sputnik and Pogrom nationalists, if you will, the more urbane nationalists who are talking about things like rule of law. You have urban liberals, urban middle class that's disillusioned, and then you have labor. Is there natural convergence here, Mark? What do you think?
I'm not sure about it. I mean, I think the first two, absolutely. I mean, because again, these are both essentially Muscovite, metropolitan, middle-class phenomena. And these are people who, on the one hand, sort of, especially back in the day, would fiercely denounce each other from opposite sides of the same cafe. And so, absolutely, they do actually share a considerable set of sort of common ground, social as much as political. The interesting point, though, is the connection with a mass constituency. And that, after all, was Navalny's great sort of challenge, which he could do to an extent in Moscow. And if he's going to stand for a presidential election, he's going to have to do on a national level. And it's been the challenge of pretty much every one of these sort of metropolitan groups that don't already start with any kind of institutional base to reach out. At the moment, first of all, there is no such thing as labour. There are lots and lots of little individuals. There are no sort of trade unions or similar blocks that you can turn to. And if you win them, there is no AFL-CIO. That once you get their endorsement, they have a machine that right. connects you then to the individual voters. So it's going to have to be.
You have labor trade unions, but they're all co-opted.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're not trade unions in any meaningful sense. They're closer to trade unions in the Soviet sense, right. as transmission belts. I mean, again, deeply corrupt. And the very fact that most of the unrest we have seen has explicitly bypassed right. the official trade unions. I mean, that says everything in that. So the question is, obviously, how do you reach out to these people? As I said, it's going to have to be much more bespoke, individual level, rather than just getting a few blocks. But secondly, it's how you articulate, how you actually say that the concerns that matter to them, which are often going to be that much more practical and immediate, are best achieved through democracy. Now, the good news is that I think, in the main, that is actually an entirely sellable answer, because it's true. Actually, the connection between democracy and economic dynamism and a potential for a more equitable share. I mean, we have realized that however ridiculous the wealth gap in the capitalist world, Russia has it even worse.
Yes.
So, and I think that there is a potentially winnable argument there. The question is whether or not you can actually make that argument to enough people.
And then there's another step. I mean, no matter how good your argument is, and no matter how well you could make it to enough people, elections are tightly controlled in Russia. They're not going to let Navalny win the presidential election. And that means in Russia, any kind of anti-establishment populist rebellion, if one does materialize, and we're not quite even close to being quite there yet, is going to have to happen on the streets, no?
No, I mean, this is not, again, going back to Anna's first point, this is not really about who wins the presidential elections. I mean, if you wanted to have a little bit of money on that, I'll happily take it. because basically, we know what the result is going to be. It's more about
what
the extent
after.
To which... elections are really important moments, because precisely they are moments of national mobilization. So in some ways, they represent, however controlled they may be, an opportunity to break up old certainties and create new ones. And I think this is it. It's actually... The question is how far this election campaign, especially if Navalny gets to run all the way to the end, how far, as a result of that, he can sow the seeds of certain levels of discussion and discourse amongst the population, as well as potentially start building up a proper institution that can stand against the Kremlin's machine for the future.
Would you agree with that, Anna?
Yeah, I would. There's a lot of caveats here. I think first, as I mentioned, the Kremlin can go back any moment and say, no, actually, we're not going to let you run. But at this point, it would be a little bit dangerous. They wouldn't want to do that for fear of sparking unrest. Secondly, Navalny's probably going to lose. And the thing is, the real question is the extent to which he's going to, like, basically the margin, right? How much rigging are they really going to have to have in place for him to lose? That's going to be the real indicator. We'll see a lot prior to the election. I mean, I just remember a similar sentiment when Mikhail Prokhorov was running against Putin. Mm-hmm. And
we all know how that turned out.
Yeah. I mean, well, obviously. And I mean, Navalny's going to have better chances. I mean, in some ways, this is almost even good for Putin to show that, hey, look, I can win a real election against Navalny. There may be surprises. I mean, if we see a similarly robust street protest movement ahead of the elections that, you know, musters enough support around Navalny, we could see some close numbers, and then things might get really interesting. But I'm still going to bet that even without rigging, Putin can win this election.
I mean, I can't help but recall, and you remember the 2013 Moscow mayoral election, which we all remember, is September 2013. Navalny exceeded everybody's expectations. I remember on this podcast, I said I thought he was going to get 20%, and everybody thought I was crazy. And he got 27. And he almost forced a second round, and they had to do some rigging to prevent that. And if you remember Navalny's speech to his supporters, thousands of supporters on the streets of Moscow that evening, and he said, someday, I'm not asking you to go out and torch cars now. Someday that day may come. And when it comes, I will be there with you.
I want to butt in here because this is extremely significant. Navalny said to me back in 2011, I remember his words very well. I asked him, why are you not running for president? And he said, we do not have an electoral system. we do not have, this is not an election. I want to take part in a real election. I mean, this was the gist of what he said. And basically as a rationale for why he wasn't running and why he's running now, I'm just curious to see, does this mean that we now do have some hope for the legitimacy?
Actually, I think it means something else. I think it means that if the last year has taught us anything, with Brexit and with Trump, and granted these things are all happening in the West, is to expect the unexpected. Because I said a zillion times and I heard a million times, Brexit can't happen. And I said a million times and I heard a million times, Trump can't win. Well, guess what? Both of those things happened. I think Navalny, as I said in the intro, has drawn some lessons from this. I think he's drawn some lessons from this. And I think that he thinks that this is potentially his moment. I mean, that's the only conclusion I can come to, given what you, and I've heard him say this in the past, that he wants to only run in real elections.
Well, yeah,
but here he is running again.
Let me give you an alternative, which is not that he thinks that this is or could be his moment. I mean, who knows? But in some ways, this is precisely about laying the groundwork. I mean, either he stood in these elections or he'd probably have to wait another 6 years. Now, to be honest, given that this is, barring constitutional changes or he has himself nominated czar or whatever, Putin's last term actually in office, he's not necessarily going to be quite so bothered as to what's going to be happening at the next presidential elections, except insofar as his own his own security is concerned. In many ways, this is the chance to really establish, for Navalny, this is the chance to establish himself precisely as the opposition figure. And the irony is that the very things that actually make this tempting for the Kremlin are also great for Navalny. They're tempting for the Kremlin because up to now, look, presidential elections have always been the same farcical process whereby a handful of entirely uncharismatic individuals quickly microwaved back to life before the election are paraded. Putin trounces them effortlessly. And anyway, they are just simply about coronation rather than election. Now, obviously, Putin wants to have his last election, a real election, to show that he can actually do it against someone with a pulse. but on the other hand, the spectacle that is then likely to happen of basically this will be an election about two people. I mean, we have no idea who else is going to start getting thrown to the mix.
But that's not going to matter.
And certainly if I was a Kremlin strategist, I'd be looking for other kind of pseudo-Navalny's to throw in to make it less of an obvious contrast. But probably it's going to end up being Putin-Navalny show. And Putin will win. But in that point, Navalny will have elevated himself into the position that, frankly, Russia has never had, which is a real opposition leader.
Right. But if your assertion that this might be something the Kremlin wants to create this kind of situation, it almost reeks of a Sarkovian plot to create a kind of fake anti-establishment show in Russia. I mean, is that where you're going with that? I mean, it's not necessarily orchestrated by Surkov himself, but it reeks of that kind of politics.
I think it's more it's Sobyanin syndrome. Yeah. I mean, it's that to give Sobyanin the chance to look like a proper legitimate figure for what is, after all, an exceedingly important job. I mean, let's face it, Mayor of Moscow is near
second
enough cabinet level
job.
Position.
Yeah.
They wanted to have some kind of opposition. And to be honest, yes, Navalny did much better than expected, but it didn't work out that badly. I mean, it did and has given Sobyanin a degree of legitimacy.
Yeah. Yeah, it elevated Navalny, but they quickly slapped him down after that. Mm-hmm. And you have to wonder, it's almost like Charlie Brown and Lucy in the football again. Is he gonna fall for this again, or is a different game being played?
This is going to be, if they're thinking that it's going to be an easy rerun of that, I suspect that they're going to be disappointed, because obviously they can always arrest him.
Right.
They can always put him in prison. But again, it's the price tag that is associated.
And we remember back in July 2013 what putting him in prison did. You remember those riots in the streets of Moscow? It's not like nothing we'd seen before.
Sure.
That was, Anna, your thoughts?
I was there. It was scary. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I was just saying, it's like if they choose to do something to him now, it really could be dangerous. I mean, we saw these riots, these pro-Navalny riots in the summer of 2013, then in the winter. And I mean, I think both sides here are writing at least several black swans, or at least they're banking on that they're somehow going to be able to you know, went out in the situation. But on another level, I see a certain convergence of interests. I mean, I see that on some level, the Kremlin might actually also be wanting to bolster institutional rule, institutional legitimacy, rather than just personalized rule. Maybe the Kremlin, too, is kind of wanting to move away from this patrimonial model. And maybe that is part of the motivation for allowing Navalny to run.
I mean, I think it's interesting, and I'm connecting dots on the fly right here, but if you remember last week, we discussed in the podcast Putin's comments to factory workers in Chelyabinsk, how, God, he's tired of being president, and he'd like to kind of complete his career successfully and go travel like an ordinary Joe. And a lot of people saw this as an important signal. Tatiana Stanovaya had a piece in Republic about this, about how this, you know, this should not be dismissed, and Putin's kind of thinking 6 years hence. And now we have Navalny entering the presidential election, and now suddenly, and it's not just us talking about how this is something that might suit the Kremlin. Bloomberg had a piece today citing Kremlin officials along those lines. The question that you have to ask is this: can this kind of spin out of control? Navalny can go off the reservation, so to speak. No, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, one of the interesting things will be precisely who starts to cohere around Navalny. I'm not necessarily saying that we will see the Navalny-Strelkov ticket, but it'll be interesting to see precisely which direction he pushes himself. But yeah, this absolutely will. The interesting thing is that this, if this is actually the case, and if this is more than just simply a little bait and switch, and they're going to just sort of 6 months down the line say, oh, I don't know, actually, there's a new court case coming or something like that. This represents a kind of reform, because precisely it will suggest a degree of wanting to legitimize the institutional over the personal, which makes sense if Putin is thinking about his future. Vozhds very rarely want to make another Vozhd to follow them.
Right.
He probably would rather a much more tedious, controllable, check-to-balance institutional regime, as long as it's a tame one.
Which is unprecedented in Russian history, I might add.
Well, yeah, but the point is, well, actually, in some ways, the Brezhnevism was interpreted, you know, okay. was in many ways that way. It was, by Soviet standards. But in that respect, you know, he may well be looking to precisely move in that direction. But if this is reform, navigating reform is always the most difficult, the most dangerous time for any authoritarian regime. And extremely rarely is it actually navigated successfully. People always think that they can pull it off. People always think that they can precisely be the playwright and the director at once. In practice, this is improv.
Now, I wanted to touch on something here about, is Navalny the right vehicle? We kind of talked about this briefly in the past, but as I noted, Navalny plays to the same cocktail that, if you will, your Trumps and Farages and Le Pens play to. It's a combination of ethno-nationalism and, you know, anti-corruption and the kind of fatigue against an entrenched elite. But Navalny adds something else to the mix, and that is that coming across all urbane and cosmopolitan as he does, he also appeals to liberals. And this makes it a potentially even more potent cocktail in Russia. Is Navalny the right vehicle here? Because I remember, Mark, you were arguing that perhaps he's not the right vehicle. Maybe an Udaltsov is a better vehicle, or Sergei Udaltsov, the far left leader. Do you
well, that's if you want to break the system. I mean, anyway, the question is whether or not you actually want a challenger who will try and shatter, or a reformer who will try and move. And Navalny, for all his clear challenging of the Kremlin, is much more in the kind of reform model. But I think one point to actually make is, look, yes, both Navalny and the Trumps and Farages of this world are anti the sort of the existing status quo. But you've got to realize there is a huge difference between anti a democratic status quo,
yes,
and anti an authoritarian,
yes,
status quo. So, I mean, in that respect, I mean, I think actually Navalny is worlds apart from these insurgent challengers, who all of them in their own way represent authoritarianism.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Anti-establishmentism in the West is many people fear it's going to veer towards authoritarianism. Anti-establishmentism in Russia, as we noted earlier, veers towards democracy.
And this is sort of Anna's earlier point, precisely about how populism, you know, is basically a mirror image
And how Russians were populist and anti-establishment before it was cool. And as we know, the Kremlin has many towers, and I'm sure this is probably being debated in the Kremlin right now. No, I mean, this is not, I don't think we have a monolithic policy right now, which is why we may see it veer off in different directions, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think one of the reasons I think Navalny actually might be a good vehicle, over the years, I've had my doubts about this, but looking back on this now, especially now, he has a pretty striking capability, which he shares with Putin, to absorb different, let's say, towers or interests or platforms, In a way, kind of mirroring to people what they want to hear, what they want at that particular moment. I mean, he feels the moment. He's a lawyer. He's extremely pragmatic. He's very charismatic in the sense, this plays into the whole Russian fixation on leadership rather than institutionalism. And it's very important that you do have a leader like that. He's versatile, which is also extremely important in the Russian context. And I'm thinking, yes, he could be that vehicle because he has demonstrated capabilities of not just the potential for reform, as Mark said, but also the beginnings of potential for working with different movements, different factions, possibly even different Kremlin factions. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm going to remain hopeful there.
I mean, if I were Sergei Kiryenko, who's the deputy Kremlin chief of staff in charge of politics right now, and supposedly this should be his game if this is being managed in the Kremlin, one would think, right? If I were Sergei Kiryenko, and I'd be looking out at the political landscape right now, and you look at, okay, Putin lost the urban middle class back in 2010, 2011, and he threw his lot in with what? Nationalists in the working class. Well, now you see labor unrest and you see nationalists turning against him. If I were looking at this, I would be looking towards some kind of, to pull out a Serkovian phrase, managed populism, right? To manage some kind of transition here. But knowing the Kremlin, I would know that Kiryenko is not the only tower there. There are going to be other towers. Mark, you said that, you know, even though Volodin's moved over to the Duma, he probably still keeps his finger in the till in terms of political management in the Kremlin. Vladislav Surkov's finger is never far from the till as well. You're probably seeing a debate among the Kremlin spinmeisters and political managers right now about what to do. Right now, it looks like this scenario we're playing out here is being road tested. No, and future events are going to tell whether they decide to risk this or not.
Yeah, as I mean, this is early enough that precisely they have time to practice mix and course correction, shall we say? But also, the interesting thing is at the moment things are looking to shape up very much like a one versus one election.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to do is see if precisely that they actually are going to want to keep it in those terms, which might make it more manageable but also more dangerous,
mm-hmm.
or precisely whether actually we're going to start seeing more figures popping up. And we could even see a situation not just where there's a whole variety of sort of Navalny's and pseudo-Navalny's, but also one in which actually there are candidates who represent, shall we say, different kind of philosophical approaches about where to take the presidential election. Because the good thing is, in some ways, what's good about the presidential election is that we basically know how it's going to go. We know who's going to win. The point is not just about winning an election, or in many ways, actually, the point is least about winning an election. That's the one thing that's a given.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of how, in some ways, to harness the potential forces that are going to be necessarily whipped up by an election campaign, especially in these rather troubled times, and what you do with them. So in some ways, actually, what we're seeing is less about the election and more about the 2018 onwards presidential
right.
term.
Yeah, no, I think the future is kind of being brokered and negotiated right now. Now, another thing to look at is, and Mark, you touched on this, is what the other opposition or so-called opposition or pseudo-opposition is going to do. I mean, Zhirinovsky's going to run, right? And he's going to get his chunk of the electorate there. Zhuganov is going to run again, and he's going to get his chunk.
I think you're 90% right or 95% right. But again, if there is the possibility that they're thinking in terms of actually giving the appearance of pluralism with a variety of potential credible candidates. Having Zhuganov there is a placeholder. It's just there is someone with a moment, a kind of a pulse, however sluggish, right, to go by the, you know, the Communist Party right logo. It would be interesting, though, theoretically, we might see someone, you know, of a younger generation. Now, I don't know.
The communist, no, not any somebody else, you mean?
Yeah. There's no indications yet. But the point is, I think the interesting thing is exactly, I think this is policy which is currently very much being created on the fly.
Right.
So it's not like they've already got it all sorted out. But the odds are you're right about Zhuganovsky.
Yeah, and Zhuganov. And then, of course, Yavlinsky's going to run again.
Yeah.
But this is where I get, because some of these figures do have, Yablka has agency, right? They can decide, we're going to support Navalny, even though they kicked him out of the party. But they could, Yablka could make that decision. The liberal opposition could decide, we're going to coalesce around Navalny. And the nationalists could decide, the moderate nationalists could decide, we're going to coalesce around Navalny. Or they could we could have this show of 1,000 popping up heads, you know, splitting up the vote. And then you're going to get the Russian election like you always wanted to get it. Because I think it's in Navalny's interest to have a one-on-one showdown here as well. So a lot depends on what the opposition does. Do liberals coalesce around Navalny or not? Anna, what do you think?
I think they're going to have. If they've learned any lessons from their previous, I mean this recent campaign where they precisely again once again failed to coalesce around anybody or anything. I would hope this would be an indication that they will at least try to coalesce around Navalny. But I think even that is, I'm not sure to the extent to which that is going to be a decisive factor. I mean, I'm still thinking it's going to be a matter of to what extent he's going to play into the zeitgeist locally. It's a lot about that in Russia, and we still have a bit of time to go. I mean, ahead of the election, we may see some protest movements, or we may not. And I think that's going to be pretty indicative of what Navalny will have to actually tap into.
Yeah, no, these are early days. The election is 15 months away. But what Navalny's announcement this week did guarantee that this is probably not going to be one of your typical boring Russian presidential elections. It's going to be something a little bit different than we've seen in the last several cycles. And I think we could probably all agree on that. On that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and take a look at Forbes magazine's decision for the fourth straight year to name Vladimir Putin the most powerful man in the world. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from Moscow is journalist Anna Arutunyan, author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Самый влиятельный человек на планете.
Снова Путин.
Владимир Путин вновь во главе рейтинга самых влиятельных.
Первое место Владимир Путин занимает уже четвертый раз.
Российский президент добивается того, чего он хочет, его влияние.
От решения российского лидера.
When Forbes named Владимир Путин the world's most powerful man for the first time back in 2013, it generated snickers. Nobody is snickering now. In naming Putin for the fourth straight year, Forbes wrote that, quote, from the motherland to Syria to the U.S. presidential elections, Putin continues to get what he wants. Unconstrained by conventional global norms, his reach has magnified in recent years, adding that, quote, Putin's power may go largely unchecked for years to come. Mark, your thoughts, and I know you're skeptical.
Well, I mean, I must admit, we start with this particularly sort of fatuous annual exercise whereby Forbes ensures that it gets a considerable amount of free advertising. But I think particularly because it has this notion...
Cynic.
Oh,
cynic.
Absolutely.
You cynic.
It has this notion, really, that history and politics are, again, it's sort of positively 100 plus years out of date, the doings of great men, and they do tend to be men. I think I can understand why they say this, in the sense that the thing about Putin is that he is a leader who has considerable sort of resources at his disposal, but above all, pretty much no checks and balances. You know, if one looks at the, you know, President Obama, clearly the president of a vastly, vastly stronger state, but also one who is constrained both by his own character and also by a political system, and by desire not to completely sort of basically set the world aflame. So I suppose I can understand the point, but the trouble is I have two problems with it. One is that it absolutely plays to Putin's own myth-making, and this big thing's... The trouble is it becomes in some ways a self-fulfilling prophecy to an extent, in the same way as you actually have this extraordinary willingness to see Putin as the sort of the grand chess player behind everything that, that goes wrong for the West. So this is just another manifestation of that. But secondly, it dramatically understates the costs of what Putin is doing. Yes, at the moment, Putin, you know, seems to be sort of doing very well geopolitically, but it's a phenomenal long and short-term cost. And therefore, in some ways, it almost encourages him, because, let's be honest, I don't believe Putin is so devoid of ego that he himself has not been told about this and relishes it.
I suspect you're right.
So I think it just encourages him to think, well, this is how you become the world's most powerful man. It's precisely by adventurism, by interference, and by not caring about tomorrow.
Now, I mean, this has been every year since 2013. But this, for me, was the first year that it actually struck me as more or less appropriate, because who else are you going to name this year, right? I mean, this is the first year I'm not saying, oh, come on, when I see this. Anna, the title of your book is The Putin Mystique. Has the Putin Mystique gone global?
Well, yes, I'm afraid it has, and thank you for plugging my book. I'm also afraid that I, you know, played a role in that same myth-making, as I think we all have to some extent. But yeah, I was in New York recently, and people were telling me they were rereading The Putin Mystique with Trump in mind, which just kind of saddened me. No. Thank you for rereading my book and everything. That's great.
I'm always happy to plug your book.
No. I mean, it is a pretty scary phenomenon that we've tapped into. I'm noticing. Back in 2013, in October, actually, I wrote a column for the Moscow News called "America's Putin Envy," and where I, you know, even back then, we were seeing a lot of Republicans talking about how they wanted a leader like Putin. This was before Trump came along.
This report came out in 2013 from the Kremlin called World Conservatism's New Leader Vladimir Putin, spelled out this plan. Yeah.
And I mean, it's almost like the rest of the world was, well, okay, the West was kind of really looking at this with envy. And I mean, I'm sad to say it's true, because what I was really describing in my book, the will to follow a person rather than an institution, it's an exasperation with the futility of institution and the rule of law and government as it is. And at its worst, it's a form of hopelessness, and populist strongmen like Putin tend to weaponize that hopelessness. And it's to the detriment of the population on the social psychological sense.
But I wanted to, for the benefit of those listeners who haven't read your book, and shame on them, can you give us kind of the Cliff Notes version of what the Putin Mystique is, and maybe how it's gone global? Because what you describe is something that was happening in Russia, but now I think we are seeing this go global.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this since the Trump victory, almost kind of reassessing in some ways what I was talking about in my book. In the Putin Mystique, I lay out two forms of government, the patrimonial state and the legal rational state. And I focus on the patrimonial state, which is essentially getting things done through appealing to the leader. And this works the leader being Putin. I mean, I was examining the relationship between different strata of society with their leader, how the communication process, the exchange, the transactional relations, and it's fascinating to see how well this system works when the actual legal rational system doesn't. It's not a matter of Putin's popularity. It's not a matter of, you know, something about the Russian soul. It was a matter of people actually being able to appeal to Putin, bypassing, if we're talking about labor again, bypassing labor unions, bypassing their governors, bypassing any institutional any institution that they could, to go directly to their leader and getting what they want out of him. This perpetuated, kind of played in, revitalized a personality cult, because this is what happens in these kind of situations. But this was largely driven. I examined it from the position of the populace, not from the position of the leader. Of course, Putin is exploiting this and he's taking advantage of it. But the point is that these kind of transactional relations between ruler and ruled, bypassing institutions, they become very much in demand when those institutions stop working. Or as we're seeing in the West, when trust in those institutions plummets. And that's the really dangerous thing, because Russia has kind of been, it's been in this situation for centuries. In the West, it's kind of what I'm fearing is that it's kind of like wanting to flirt with this patrimonial state, going back, kind of basically throwing out 300 years of progress, and that's what's really scary, and almost far scarier to me than what I see happening in Russia right now.
No, as we discussed in the first half, maybe we're going to see things move in a different direction in Russia. Mark, I saw you're writing, which means you're thinking, which means you have something to say. Do you agree the Putin mystique is going global?
Well, yeah, and in many ways for the same reasons. Look, if the Forbes magazine thing had been Putin, the world's most powerful symbol, then in some ways I think actually it would have been far more accurate and useful. Because absolutely, I mean, what the current Putinophilia that we have seen, thoroughly uninformed that it may be, around a whole variety of individuals, is the same kind of thing that once upon a time we saw people sort of lauding Mussolini as the man who made the trains run on time, or indeed Hitler or Stalin as people who could industrialise and get a country moving. The thing is, it's this mythical Putin. It's this Putin that is the sort of the guardian of national interests without constraint, the chief executive without a board, leadership shorn of any kind of wishy-washy, pastel-toned compromise. A heroic model which appeals to us at the moment, because precisely we're at a time in which we are feeling that our institutions are failing to do what we want them to do, and as a result, therefore, we lose faith in them. Now, of course, the fact of the matter is that if you're a Russian, your experience of Putin is very, very different from how it may look from a nice, convenient, sort of cosy nook in America or in Britain or wherever else. But that's the whole point. In some ways, the mythic Putin that people aspire to is precisely he is the solution for all the problems that we see in our current system, without us really looking at actually what that solution means.
So it's the Putin of the Che Guevara T-shirt that Peter Pomerantsev, steal that quote that I love so much from Peter Pomerantsev. We're bumping up against the end here. Anna, any last thoughts before we wrap it up?
No, I think we've said it all quite well.
We've said it all.
there's actually a bit of optimism this time around. I'm happy. And today there was a lot of sunlight in Moscow. Maybe that's why.
Uncharacteristic sunlight here in Prague too. I thought I was transported to another city or something when I saw the sun today, which is you don't often see in the city. All right, Mark, any last thoughts? All right, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today since we've said it all. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from Moscow has been journalist Anna Arutunyan, author of the book The Putin Mystique: Inside Russia's Power Cult. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
Pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our patient, brilliant, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.